we're continuing our series in the Old Testament, and we're going to be in the book of Esther today. So if you want to turn your Bibles there, mine is page 720. I don't know where it is for you, but if you turn to page 720, maybe you'll see something good. But I love having a family, and they're going to throw a picture up of my family. And this is my wife, Kristen, okay? Our first son, Carden, second son, Lincoln, first girl, Claiborne, and second girl, Caraway. And so we have four kids, and I love them to death. They are tough at moments, as some of you know, but they can be so sweet. I don't know that I've seen a better commercial for kids than the sweet and sour commercial for Sour Patch Kids, right? It can happen. But I love them the most, I think, right now for their imagination. I love it. You know, they love creating just outlandish stories. And they want to tell them. They want to tell the whole thing, right? And especially my second son, Lincoln, he loves telling stories, okay? We picked him up from his grandparents' house yesterday, and he had told me 14 stories by the time we got home. Most of them were not true. They were just made up. But they were fun to listen to. And one of the most recent ones that they created, because I love to write them down. When they start talking and babbling, if I'm in a place where I can write, I just write them down and record them, because maybe one day they'll be as sentimental as I am and they'll want to read them, okay? The last one they created, they titled, this is them, My Dream World. And you can only imagine what a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old can come up with in their dream world. Well, it was full of T-Rexes. It was full of race cars. There were big houses. There was violence that we had to work on, okay? But they created this huge fairy tale. And today, as we read into Esther, we're going to read a story that actually works and has the character arc of a fairy tale. But truly, when you look at stories in the Bible, they're not fairy tales. They're accounts. And so if you're turning there with me in the book of Esther, let's jump into the account of Esther, okay? So this book takes place during the Persian exile, about 539 to 331 BC. And this particular book takes place after the return to Jerusalem. If you guys remember, I mean, there are several books in the Bible that talk about the Israelites being released from captivity, being able to go home and rebuild themselves. And this book takes place after that. So when you read about the Jewish people in this book, you got to understand that these are the people who chose to stay behind. They chose to stay in Persia. Okay, they had been given the chance to go home, and they said, you know what? I've kind of made my life here, and so I'm going to stay. I'm going to keep building on my life where it is. And there are four big main characters that we're going to look at. King Ahasuerus, that is a hard name, so we'll just call him Xerxes, because that's who scholars, people way smarter than I am, believe that that's who that was, King Xerxes. Haman, who's going to be our main antagonist. Mordecai, who is Esther's cousin / legal guardian. And then Esther, the main character of the book, the one the book is written after. So we're going to look in this book as this seemingly nobody becomes a somebody and has a chance to do something huge with her life based on the platform and the influence that she's given. And as we look in this book, it's going to seem like there's a ton of coincidences that happen. But if you want to write something down and you're taking notes, you should write down that there are no coincidences with God. That God is sovereign above all. In my house, I told you I have little kids. In my house, there is a scream and a cry that rings out a lot. The word mine. Does this picture ring any bells? Yes, if you have kids or you're a huge fan of Finding Nemo, you know that this picture right here brings back so many memories. You can hear the voices, mine, 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 in your head right now, okay? I hear that once, twice, two, three, four, five, six, seven, a billion times a week, because there's always some kind of territory battle happening in my house, okay? Whether it's a blanket, it's a pillow, it's a toy, it's a personal space, right? Like Lincoln or Carden, Claiborne, they just wake up on the wrong side of the bed and they don't want to talk to anybody. I get it. I'm there. I've been there, okay? That cry rings out, right? When someone encroaches on their territory, the mine reaches in. I mean, it comes out of everywhere. You can hear it at all corners of our house, even though we put our kids in the basement. It's a built-out basement. There's AC, beds, I promise. Even though we put them there, okay, we can still hear the screams of mine. And truly, when we look at the book of Esther, you're not going to hear God's name. God's name isn't mentioned one time, but God's presence and his sovereignty is in the fiber of this book. It's in the very being of this book. Andrew Kuiper says it this way. He says, there's not a square inch in the whole domain of human existence over which Christ, who is Lord of all, does not exclaim, mine. And that is so true when you look at this book of Esther. That God is in every single scenario, word, phrase in this book. And you're going to see it as we look in here. But as I was looking into, why God's not in this book and maybe how we live our lives based on situations where we don't feel God is present, a lot of stats came up that most Americans hold to. Luck stats. So let me read these. In the United States today, Americans hold to a lot of superstitions. And truly, as I was studying this and reading this, I got really convicted by some superstitions that I kind of hold to, okay? That I like try to fight on a daily basis, truly. Let me read these. 27% of Americans believe a four-leaf clover is lucky. 23% believe breaking a mirror is bad luck. I've been there. Even when mirrors break today, I'm kind of like, should I feel bad? Should I go do something? Right? Like, it's just ingrained. 22% believe that knocking on wood will bring good luck. I do this. I don't believe in it, but I do it. Maybe I should reconsider that. 21% believe walking under a ladder is bad luck. We're doing construction in our garage, and I have an open ladder. I avoid that thing with my entire life, okay? Literally from a small child, I've been taught that don't walk under that ladder, you know, don't break a mirror, right? Like, there's just luck ingrained in us. 18% believe that opening an umbrella indoors is bad luck. If I brought one on stage right now and went, there'd be a portion of you guys that went, oh, don't follow that guy later. And 13% believe that the number 13 is unlucky. And finally, according to a recent Gallup survey, this is important, 26% of American adults believe that the stories in the Bible are real stories about God working through historical events. Here's why that's important. 74% of people don't. 26% they put a very positive spin on 26% of people believing the stories in the Bible are real. But the truth of that story is that 74% of Americans, people sitting next to you, people that you see every day, do not believe the stories in the Bible are real. And that's the reality we live in. That's the world we live in today. Write this down, top of your notes, scribble it in, marker it, scream it to the person next to you. God is Lord over all. God is Lord over all. There's no luck, there's no chance, there's no coincidence involved. It is God, and he is Lord over every moment of your life. Proverbs 16:33 reads this way, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. I mean, there's a moment in Esther where literal dice are tossed, right? For a game of chance to see when Haman gets to set up these gala or gets to take part in this execution. And Proverbs 16:33 says that God was in control of those dice. And you'll see why. So let's jump in. If you're taking notes, I want to say one more thing. God is not a God of chance, but of purpose. God is not a God of chance, but of purpose. And Sylvia Thompson says it this way, the more I come to terms with the realization that God is present in every facet of my life, the more prominent he becomes. It's as if he's saying to me, yes, it's me. I've been here all along. God is in the details. He's here, and he's present. So chapter 1, Jumping into Esther chapter 1, here's what we see. We see King Ahasuerus, or King Xerxes, however you're scribbling it in your notes. We see that he's throwing a huge party for himself and all the officials just to show his glory. It's like a 180-day party. It's a massive party. He's inviting people from everywhere, all the officials, to come and join him to see his power and his wealth and how great he's done. He brings all the people in to celebrate. And one of his prized possessions that he wants to see everyone celebrate is his wife, Vashti. So he's like, get her in here. And she's like, not on your life. No way. Not a chance. And so the king's buddies kind of get up in his ear. This is chapter one. They kind of get up in his ear. They're like, you're going to let her do that to you? You can't do that. What is that going to do through the whole kingdom? So the king sets a decree out. They set a decree out. Vashti's removed as queen. She's no longer queen. And then we get to chapter two, where the king has cooled down. He has chilled out a little bit, and he has become lonely. He's become lonely. And his confidants get back in his ear, and they go, hey, you know what you need? A queen. No, duh. You need a queen. So they pull all their brain power together, and they go, hey, here's what you should do. You should call in a bunch of lucky ladies, have them parade in front of you, and take part in Bachelor Season 1. I don't know if you guys watch that. I don't. All the time. I have to. It's on in my house. I don't have to. That's a lie. I choose to because it's funny. But seriously, Bachelor Season 1 happens, okay? Right here in Esther, all these women are paraded in front of the king. They have a year. They have a year to get prepared, a year to get geared up to be presented to the king, and they get to take whatever they want in front of the king so that they can win his favor. They have one chance. They have one chance to win his favor. If they don't win his favor, they get to go backstage and just be another one of the girls. So here is where Mordecai and Esther enter, okay? And Mordecai enters Esther into this beauty contest, okay, this queen contest, Bachelor Season 1. And she, verse 17, gets to parade in front of the king. And in verse 17, here's what happens. The king loved Esther. I'm sure Mordecai was screaming at the top of his lungs, we won, right? Like, we did it. We did it. Well, you didn't. She did. But the king loved Esther more than all the other women. She won more favor and approval from him than did any of the other virgins. He placed the royal crown on her head and made her queen in place of Vashti. So she gains favor with the king. She gains his hand. She gains his place. She gains his seat. And she becomes queen instead of Vashti. As we make it into chapter 3, or sorry, at the end of chapter 2, we see that a couple of the king's men that guard, that sit at the gate, that guard the gate, they plan to assassinate the king. Well, Mordecai, this is his second role, okay? First role is to toss Esther into this beauty contest. The second role, he just overhears them talking about assassinating the king. So, well, now he has a hand next to the king. So he hears it, he goes and tells Esther. Esther goes and tells the king, and the plot is foiled. As we make it into chapter 3, Haman is our main antagonist, remember that? Haman is brought into the picture. And I don't know if there's any correlation, but at the end of chapter 3, the plot is foiled to assassinate the king. And at the beginning of chapter 3, at the end of chapter 2, at the beginning of chapter 3, Haman becomes the king's second in command. The king celebrates him. He throws a big party for him. And Haman is literally riding on the clouds. Verse 5, though, he's exiting the king's palace. Verse 5 and 6 read this way. When Haman saw that Mordecai was not bowing down or paying him homage, he was filled with rage. So the people literally were celebrating Haman. I mean, he had just been risen to second in command. The people are celebrating him. They're shouting his name, and you can only assume. And yet there's this Mordecai who's sitting at the king's gate, and he refuses to bow down. He refuses to celebrate him. And when I read that, the picture I got was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not bowing down to the golden idol, right? That's the picture I got. They're like, man, I know who I bow down to, and it's not you. And that's Mordecai here. I know who I bow down to, and you're not it. You're not him. Verse 6, and when, this is Haman, he learned of Mordecai's ethnic identity, it seemed repugnant to Haman to do away with Mordecai alone. He planned to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout Ahasuerus' kingdom. So the king is Persian. Haman, we can only assume, is Persian. Mordecai is a Jew. Esther is a Jew. And Haman sees these people and he says, you know what? Let's just do away with all of them. I don't just not like that guy. I don't like any of them. We're going to get rid of all of them. Haman gets mad, sets out to destroy the Jewish people. And the king gives him his signet ring to make a law, to make a decree that a year from this day that they will be destroyed. Now here's something you should write down and take note in. In this time in the Persian Empire, if the king's signet ring was on it, his signature, his stamp of approval, the laws could not be undone. They could not be changed. They could not be altered. Once it was in place, it happened. So Haman puts this in place. He puts the king's signet ring on it, and this law is there. And the people begin to freak out. I mean, literally, they run into confusion. So much so that Mordecai gets really extreme. This happens a few times in the Bible. I laugh every time. Mordecai tears his clothes off and puts a sackcloth on. Now, I understand that was customary, but for me, that's just kind of funny, because if I saw somebody do that, I would laugh. You don't have to. It's okay. But I would, because it's just abnormal. It is abnormal. Now, for them, it was a sign of mourning, okay? It was the way that they mourned, that they grieved, okay? And so he tears his clothes. He puts a sackcloth on. He begins to weep. And Esther gets ear of Mordecai doing this. And they begin to have a dialogue. And Esther finds out that in fact, this law to destroy the Jews has been put in place, and she becomes filled with fear. She becomes afraid. She becomes worried. And Mordecai says, you got to do something about it. This is your platform. This is your place. Look, you are the king's queen. This is your chance. And she replies back to him, I don't know if I can. I'm not, I don't think I can do that. And then in chapter 4, verse 13, Mordecai told the messenger to reply to Esther, don't think that you will escape the fate of all the Jews because you are in the king's palace. Verse 14, if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will come to the Jewish people from another place, but you and your father's family will be destroyed. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. Those powerful words, for such a time as this. And that's such a truth for us today. You're here for such a time as this. You're where you are. You have the influence you have, the position you have, the things you have for such a time as this. Mordecai simply tells her, you're not going to escape the fate. You're going to be just like one of us. Even though you're queen, you're going to be just like one of us. Chapter 5. Here's where it starts to get kind of tricky. On the third day, Esther dressed in her royal clothing. So Esther goes back to Mordecai, and she's like, hey, listen, get everybody together, pray. I'm going to go do this thing, okay? So she throws on her royal clothing, stood at the inner courtyard of the palace facing it. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the courtroom, facing its entrance. Now, this is important, okay? Esther makes herself available to the king, okay? She gets in eyeshot of the king. Now, if the king disapproves, Esther is out, okay? He could immediately have her executed. That's just one of the laws. That sounds crazy? It's just one of the laws. He could immediately have her executed if she does not find favor in his presence. So she musters up all her courage. She musters up her boldness. She gets in place where the king can see her. And verse 2, as soon as the king saw Queen Esther standing in the courtyard, she gained favor with him. The king extended the gold scepter in his hand toward Esther, and she approached and touched the tip of the scepter. "What is it, Queen Esther?" the king asked her. "Whatever you want, even to half the kingdom, will be given to you. If it pleases the king," Esther replied, "may the king and Haman come today to the banquet I have prepared for them." The king said, "Hurry, get Haman so we can do as Esther has requested." I mean, the king loves Esther. He loves her, right? She says it and he's like, "I'm on it. Let's go. I'm in. Get him here now. I don't care what he's doing. Clear my schedule and let's go. Dinner on me tonight." So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. While drinking the wine, the king asked Esther, "Whatever you ask will be given to you. Whatever you want, even a half the kingdom, will be done." Esther answered, "This is my petition and my request. If I have found favor in the eyes of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and perform my request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet I will prepare for them. Tomorrow I will do what the king had asked." She's right there. The moment is in front of her. And yet, it didn't happen. She has the keys of the kingdom in her hand. The king's like, "Whatever you want, it can happen." All she has to do is say, "That guy is trying to kill all of us." And it's done. Right? The king would do something about it. He would save. He would be able to pull her out and change the course of history. And yet she gets scared. Or, as we're going to see, the moment just wasn't right. So I met my wife while she was interning at the place that I worked. Yes, I married the intern, okay? It is what it is, okay? It is what it is at this point. We're going to celebrate 7 years of being married in about a week, and so it's working out so far, okay? She keeps me around. So when we first met, okay, she was dating somebody, so I kept my distance. I have never been that person. And so, we didn't talk like almost her whole internship until the last couple weeks. Well, old boy gets thrown in the trash, and I said, "What's up? Hey." And kind of slid my way in, all right? Some people would say weaseled, but I don't like to use that word, okay? I just like to say I was at the right place at the right time, all right? So, I worked my way in and ended up asking her on a date. And we went on three dates in the span of about a week and a half, okay? Because I was thinking, man, this girl, I was in Texas at the time. I'm thinking, this girl is about to go back to Virginia. If I'm going to make an impression, it's got to be now, okay? So we go on a few dates, and in my mind, I'm like, man, this deal is sealed, okay? It's been a week and a half. I am in love. I didn't say that to her, but I'm like, I'm in love. This girl is my future. She's my forever. And so she gets in her car and is on her way home and gets in a wreck, okay? Not a bad wreck. She says she hit a tire in the road and it blew out her front end, whatever that means, okay? Anyways, she had to leave her car and fly back home, okay? And they had to repair a car. Well, when the time came to come get her car, her dad, we had still been talking a little bit, and her dad was like, "Hey, I'm going to send her sister's boyfriend down." And I was like, "No, you're not. I am here for such a time as this." And her dad's like, "No, I insist." And I'm like, no, sir, you don't understand. I insist, okay? I'm going to drive that car back because I was set. Like, I was set on impressing her. I was set on making this happen, okay? And that might sound a little stalkerish. It wasn't, okay? I promise you just had to be there. But so I'm like, man, I'm going to drive her car back. Well, Houston to Lynchburg, Virginia is 21 hours. And I'm thinking, man, how can I just, I'm thinking of all the ways I can impress her, okay? Like, what can I do to impress her? What can I do to really just, man, get a reaction, make her think I'm the best? I'm gonna drive it 21 straight hours. I'm there. And I did, okay? Now, when I got out of the car, my legs were jello. I felt sick, but I did. And we had a great weekend. Truly, we had a great weekend. We saw her family, met her parents. I was like, man, I am in, all right? At this point, we were like, it was like 3 months, okay? And I was like, man, we've been dating for 3 months. We're in. I'm in. And her dad tells the story this way. When I left, her dad looked at my back, okay, saw me walking into the airport and thought, that is a dead man walking. We will never see that guy again. Because as much as I had tried to hold on to the moment, she wasn't there. And the moment wasn't the moment, right? It was not the right moment for us to be together. And truly, in all the moments, I thought I was going to be the knight in shining armor. But where I felt the moment was right, God knew that it wasn't. You know, we both needed different moments to propel us forward on our relationship to get us to the right moment to say yes to each other. So if you ask us, one party would say that we've been together 8.5 years. The other party would say we've been together like 7.75. But that's neither here nor there. And as we look at the story of Esther, truly, she's in this moment, but it wasn't the right moment. It wasn't the right moment. And so Esther calls a second party, a second banquet, and she brings them in, and they're sitting at the table. They're sitting at the table together. They're lounging, they're eating, the king asks Esther, what can I give you? What can I do? And Esther, in a moment's notice, looks right at the king at this second dinner and says, Haman, the enemy, is sitting at the table with us. The king asks her, what can I give you? And she's like, help me, help my people. Give us freedom, give us hope, give us peace, give us a place. And he goes, who? Who is it? Who's oppressing you? Who's the person that's in your way? Who's the person that's causing this pain? She says, Haman. The enemy before me is Haman. It's so interesting. That's chapter 7, verse 6. I think it's so important that when we look at our lives and we look at the way things are going in our lives, we always have to notice that there's an enemy that wants to steal our joy, our hope. You put your line under there. That wants to kill our life and wants to destroy everything we hold dear. And that enemy is very present in the book of Esther. Listen, I mean, there's 10 chapters. There's way more we could walk through. There's way more we could talk about. Because truly, after Haman leaves the first dinner and goes home, he interacts with Mordecai again. And he is so distraught in his interaction with Mordecai that he goes and he builds these gallows. He unloads on his friends and his wife, and they give him a good idea to build these gallows. So he builds these gallows 75 feet tall so that he can make an example of this guy. And the gallows that were meant for evil became the gallows that gave the Jewish people freedom. And truly for us today in the room, the gallows that are meant for our death, whatever it is that Satan has built up, that he's planted roots, they're meant for your death. But the same wood from the gallows that are meant for your death, the same wood that Jesus was nailed to, that are meant for your life. When we look in the book of Esther, you see a ton of coincidences. And I just want to read these, because this is an overview, and you should go read the book of Esther for yourself and study this, okay? But here's what I want you to know as we wrap this up, as we close this out. You're taking notes, you should write these down. Coincidences are often God's hand at work. Coincidences are often God's hand at work. When you read the book of Esther, there's a ton of coincidences. But those coincidences are God's hand at work. They're God in the details. They're God purposing your life for something more than maybe even what you notice and believe. And when you look at the book of Esther, Esther just happens to be Jewish. She just happens to be beautiful. Esther just happens to be favored by the king. Mordecai just happens to overhear the plot against the king's life. A report of this just happens to be written in the king's chronicles. Haman just happens to notice that Mordecai does not kneel and bow before him. When Haman plots his revenge, The dice just happened to be a year out. Esther just happens to get the king's approval to speak with him. Esther just happens to not take the first moment in the day so that Haman can go home and just by chance have his friends and his wife there tell him that in that same day he should build gallows. The next day, Esther had just happened to call another dinner that Haman was invited to. And as Haman shows up to that dinner, the gallows just happened to be finished. And the king just happens to find out that Haman's the one trying to destroy his wife, his queen. I love the coincidences in that book. I love the position and the influence that Esther had. And I love the reality that we see in her life, the fear. Maybe even for some of you, the anxiety that maybe she felt. Maybe the stress that she felt in that moment, because it makes her real, right? And when you read about a character that's real, you can relate to that. You can put yourself in their shoes. I know that I did. I know that I have. And here's what you should hear. Number one, coincidences are often God's hand at work. Number two, God gives us influence not for our pleasure, but for his purpose. You see, Esther wasn't brought to her position, happen chance, just to enjoy a great life. God wanted that for her, obviously. But he also put her in her position of influence for his purpose. I'll say it another way. Sometimes big doors swing on small hinges. There were a lot of small moments that led up to a big salvation. Number three, God cares more about using your position than securing your protection. Esther was in a ton of danger. A ton of danger. And yet, in her boldness, she stepped up to the plate and knocked it out of the park and provided freedom where there was not freedom, provided hope where there was no hope, provided salvation where there was no salvation. The last one, Esther points us to Christ. I feel like oftentimes we're caught in a circle of coincidences, and we don't see that God's in the details. I would challenge you this morning to change your perspective and realize that every single thing that you've been given is from God, for God, and there's no other way to live life. No other way to live life. You know, one detail we left out, that I left out, that you can read about in the beginning is that Esther actually had two names. She had two names. She had her Persian name and her Jewish name, and this was common. This was common for the Jewish people to have two names, one that was relatable to the people of the culture they were living in, and one that was relatable to their home, to their faith, to their religion, to their God. And Esther, her name means star. That's her Persian name. It means star. It's related to the local deity Ishtar, the goddess of war and sexual love. And yet you see her called by another name in the very beginning, Hadassah. Hadassah was her Jewish name, and that name means myrtle. There's a picture of myrtles. This is a close-up of a myrtle. And when you read about myrtles in the Bible, you can find it several times, a myrtle tree or the myrtle. It's always related to situations of healing, restoration, and peace. You want to talk about God being in the details and God being sovereign and God being present from the beginning to the end without his name ever being said? That's his name written all over her life. Esther, who was chosen in a sexual way by a war-filled and conquering nation, is reminded of her foundation in God as Hadassah, through which she uses that foundation as one of healing, restoration, and peace. Even in the beginning, God was working to the end. For all of us in the room, I don't know where you sit today. I don't know what God has spoken to you today. But what I hope is that God has begun to reveal that in the beginning, He's always been there. In the present, He is currently there. And in the end, He will be there. In the book of Esther, she was called for such a time as this to do exactly the right thing at the right moment, to be exactly who God called her to be in that time and in that moment. And for all of us today, we have a decision to make. When you leave this room, when we sing this next song, what are we going to do with the positions and the influence that God has given us? What are we going to do with the details that God's been working in our life? What are we going to do with the things that we have? Maybe your thing is joy. That's great. What are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? In Esther's position, she stepped up to the plate, knocked it out of the park. Irwin McManus is a pastor on the West Coast, and recently he said a quote that says, "The future belongs to the bold." And truly it does. The future belongs to the bold. We live in a post-Christian world that needs bold people to step into the king's palace and live on fire for Jesus Christ, knowing that in the beginning, He's been working to the moment we are in now, and He will continue working to the moment at the end. That in the beginning, He purposed you and me for something greater than ourselves, for something kingdom-driven, for an eternal purpose. Don't leave here today without knowing the truth of where you stand with Jesus, without surrendering yourself to Jesus Christ, without giving what you have to God, because you're here for such a time as this. You're living in this broken, chaotic, confusing world for such a time as this. And the book of Esther calls us to do something greater than we're doing right now.